Our next case is United States against Salem.
May it please the court, Robert Handelsman.
Counsel, I'll call you when we're ready. Mr. Handelsman.
May it please the court, Robert Handelsman and Camille Knight for Janescu and Simon. On page 10 of our initial brief, we gave some examples of when a defendant would or would not be liable. You have to look at each act or course of conduct to see if that act or course of conduct constitutes assistance or agreeing to promote the co-conspirator. Example C7 in Application Note 2 tells us that knowledge and engaging in the same kind of conduct as a co-conspirator by themselves is not enough to constitute to make one liable for relevant conduct.
Mr. Handelsman, before you get too much further, I want to ask you about what standard of review you think we're operating under, because your brief says the merits are reviewed for plain error, and then, I confess a bit to my surprise, the government's brief says that clear error is the appropriate standard for everyone, including your clients, yours and Ms. Simon's clients, and
Well, you know, that's a really, really a tough one. Clear error would be...
I mean, that's an easier standard. Neither one of them is a cakewalk, but it's a somewhat easier standard than plain error.
Well, actually, I did some research, and I found that there's really not much difference between clear error and plain error because both require prejudice. But clear error is generally applied...
They are vastly different. You don't need to lecture us about the standards of review, and especially if you're going to say that the clearly erroneous doctrine and the plain error doctrine are the same. The puzzle here is that it looks like there are some defendants who made the objection in the district court and some who did not. And we have the prosecutor saying the same standard of review applies to both. Now, that is a puzzle. Like Judge Wood, I wonder if you have any views on it. We'll, needless to say, be asking Ms. Zindal about that.
All right. Well, clear error would apply if we were attacking a judge's conclusion from the evidence.
Facts are reviewed to see whether they're clearly erroneous.
Yes.
We don't want you to lecture us about the meaning of the standards of review. The puzzle is why all three defendants
are covered
by the same standard of review.
I can't speak for Salam. But in our case, because no objection was made below, it would apparently be plain error.
All right, so here's my primary issue for you. I know you have arguments about how this court has changed certain standards in Soto Piedra. I actually am dubious about that. But the thing that interests me the most is where, if at all, is a finding of what the scope of the agreement that your client joined. Because there can be an overall scheme or conspiracy, and that doesn't necessarily mean that your client joined that whole thing. Now, if your client did join the whole thing, then that's the relevant conduct to look at. But does the district court ever make that finding?
I don't believe it did. As we pointed out in the initial brief, it appears that the district court assumed that because there was foreseeability, that the district court conflated the two, assumed because there was foreseeability that was jointly undertaken activity. And the two, as our brief points out, the two are completely different things.
Well, foreseeable of what, you know, I guess?
Well, you know, it's obvious here, I think, from this record, each defendant knew what the others were doing.
Well, so, and what I want to know is does, for example, Mr. I'm not sure how he pronounces his
Janescu?
Name. Janescu?
I call it Janescu.
Janescu. Was he aware of the entire Romanian eBay scam or whatever, internet auction scam? Or did he think there was some little Chicago-based internet auction scam.
No, it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell from this record, because record really doesn't show it. He was obviously aware there were others doing what he was doing. Whether he knew there were 10 or 20 or 100 or 1,000, the record doesn't show that.
But the problem that I had with your argument is you take it down to what seemed to me just an impossibly fine-grained level. You know, did he know that the person sitting in the car next to him was going to go to the same currency exchange and do these things? I don't think the law requires that level of specificity, but somewhere in between. I mean, the law needs to say, here's the scheme he thought he was furthering, participating in, aiding, whatever word you want to use. And then for that, anything that's reasonably foreseeable is attributable to him.
Well, that's really the nub of the case. Because if you take that rule and say, well, he's helping a little bitty part of it, and helping a little bitty part of it advance the whole scheme, the provision in the application notes that talk about limitation just wouldn't be applicable. There's in pages 5 and 6 of our reply brief, we have a quote from Soto Piedra. It goes something that scope of relevant conduct is not necessarily the scope of the entire conspiracy.
And that's what I'm getting at, because if he thought that, if he was aware, and I'll just say, of a Chicago area conspiracy to rip people off with internet auctions, and in fact, unbeknownst to him, there's a really big conspiracy being operated out of Romania, etc., then he wouldn't have necessarily joined the larger conspiracy. Acts and furtherance of it wouldn't be attributable to him. There, but you need that finding of scope, I think.
Well, we don't. Well, that's the jointly undertaken activity,
yeah,
which we submit
what
we don't have. Now, the government didn't attempt to charge him with knowledge or jointly undertaking with the jointly undertaking activity with the entire conspiracy.
Now, doesn't the district court kind of talk around that, though? He looks at the government's memorandum. He looks at facts that are set out that do suggest that these people were all in it for the bigger conspiracy.
As I recall the transcript, I think this issue of jointly undertaken activity was completely omitted. The whole discussion at sentencing was about foreseeability, and there was nothing as to whether these defendants were responsible for everything and everybody on GX018, which is in our appendix. That seems to be the basis of, that's the limits of what the government feels these people should be responsible for. But that document is 9 pages. There's probably, I would guess, about 700 different acts in there. And I don't believe that the law is, even if you don't believe that Soto Piedra made a sea change in the law here, it still talks about assisting or agreeing to promote. Now, there's no evidence in this record that these defendants assisted or agreed to promote every one of those 700 acts, or how many there are. That's what we are really driving at here. And that's
but
why
if those acts were reasonably foreseeable to them, as the judge found, and they continue to participate in the conspiracy, aren't they implicitly promoting that?
Because As I mentioned before, on pages 5 and 6 of the reply brief, we have that quote from Soto Piedra. Relevant conduct is not necessarily the scope of the entire conspiracy or even a discrete part of it. That's why we say you have to look at what did these defendants assist or agree to promote.
So,
and you have to go through each individual act.
So I think you're saying that they have to be aware that another actor is going to do a certain thing, and they have to agree to it or in some way promote that particular thing.
They have to help it out in some way. That was the whole point of the Studley case. The defendant knew what everybody else was doing, but he didn't participate in it. And it's the same thing here. Now, obviously, these defendants assisted or agreed to promote some of the acts on this exhibit, but not everything. I'd like to reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Handelsman. Ms. Kister.
Morning, Your Honors. Counsel. I don't know that I can add too much more to Mr. Handelsman's remarks, other than to indicate, as the court knows, Mr. Salem did plead pursuant to a plea agreement, and that to some extent elucidates, at least from the government's perspective, what this, the scope of the scheme involved, although it's still ambiguous as to what he's admitting to, specifically with respect to knowledge and foreseeability of the acts of his co-defendants. And if you look at the plea agreement, it's page 8 in my supplemental appendix. You'll see that Mr. Salem does admit to being aware of certain co-defendants and the fact that they were doing as he was doing with these wire transfers, but it doesn't really address anything beyond his awareness of these people. And the court makes a leap from that admission to foreseeability. And the other problem is that the plea agreement indicates that he's aware that his co-defendants, such as, and then goes on to list 11 or 12 of these co-defendants, that's not very specific. Is he aware specifically what each of these individuals is doing? And beyond that, is he aware of others? We don't know that from this record. There is some indication that there were several groups here. There were at least 20 individuals. He's associated with 11 or 12 of these people. I'm not sure why from this record. He's put in this one discrete group. And even if he is, what in their acts should be attributed to him? We don't know that. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Imdahl.
May it please the court, my name is Stephanie Zimdahl and I represent the United States.
So Ms. Zimdahl, let me try to explain for you a little further what is bothering me. Under the application notes to 1B1.3, it says the court must first determine the scope of the criminal activity the particular defendant agreed to jointly undertake. And I don't see that here. And I want to give you an example of where I think reasonable foreseeability isn't enough to do it. It is reasonably foreseeable to me that the Latin Kings are going to use guns in furtherance of their cocaine conspiracies. In fact, it's completely foreseeable to me after all these years in the court that they're doing that. But I haven't joined their conspiracy. And so the fact that it's reasonably foreseeable to me that they're going to engage in that criminal activity isn't enough to say that I'm responsible for it. I have to have done something to have joined that. And so I feel the same thing is true here. We need to know what these defendants joined. Which criminal activity did they join, and what's its scope, as the application note says, before we then can take the next step and say, well, was it reasonably foreseeable to them that certain actions would be taken in furtherance of it?
That's correct, Your Honor, and it is true that the district court did not use the word scope in any of the sentencing proceedings here, but the sentencing hearings are replete with discussion of the scheme and the larger scheme and conversation about that.
But
and
don't we need a definition of it? I mean, I think it's too bad that the district court didn't focus in, because this appears in its broadest operation to have been a very wide-ranging criminal activity, and I just don't know if each of these three defendants were aware of the scope of the whole thing, whether we know that they really joined the whole thing?
Your Honor, there is evidence as to that in the record. And in the government's version, the government was very specific that the nature and scope of the conspiracy and of the jointly undertaken criminal activity that all three of these defendants joined was the same and was the entire scheme, eBay fraud scheme here. And the district court was fully aware of that, had read the government's version, and in fact stated that in both of the sentencing hearings and stated that he had read the PSR.
He says he's read it, but what I'm missing is the magic words, I adopt the PSR, or I agree with the government's version.
Your Honor,
you can read and listen to all sorts of evidence, and maybe you buy some of it and you don't buy some of it.
That's correct. The district court does not say in the sentencing hearings that he adopts the PSR. He did later say in the statement of reasons that accompanies the judgment and conviction that he was adopting the PSR at that point.
And does the PSR define the scope of each person's criminal
The PSR
activity?
Contains the same statements from the government's version that addresses that the scope of the conspiracy was the same and embodied the entire eBay fraud scheme for these defendants. And the record itself firmly supports the notion that all three of these defendants were participating in the entire scheme. They all three admitted that they knew that there were the foreign co-schemers that were directing this scheme from Romania, that they knew that there was a large group of conspirators here in Chicago that were participating, that they picked up the wire fraud transfers here in Chicago, and that they sent them back to Romania. They were participating in all of the many facets of this scheme. All three of them participated for over 2 years in the scheme. They were long-time participants. They had a significant knowledge, basically, of the scope of the scheme.
This is still largely directed to foreseeability. The district court, of course, did not, in the end, hold them liable for all $6 million that the Romanian principals may have received. And I assume that was because of the limitation on jointly undertaken criminal activity. Here we come back to the question whether this was preserved in the district court. Did anybody remind the district judge about the need to find that the criminal activity, to find the scope of criminal activity that was jointly undertaken, as the guideline puts it?
There is a line or two in both of the defendants. Ginescu and Simon basically filed a joint brief, or Ginescu filed a brief at sentencing that was then adopted by Simon, and Salim, of course, filed something separate. There's a line or two in each of theirs that could be construed as suggesting that perhaps what the other defendants did shouldn't be comported to them, but certainly at the sentencing hearings themselves, no, they did not. The defendants immediately went straight to the issue of reasonable foreseeability in all of their arguments, and in both of the sentencing hearings, when the judge said, reasonable foreseeability, that's the crux of the issue before me here today, they all agreed yes, and they went forward immediately.
So that's where it's critically important, in my opinion anyway, whether we are operating under a plain error standard or whether we're operating under a clear error standard, because and you said that it's clear error for everybody, so I wonder how you come to that.
Your Honor, the government believes that it was clearer simply because they have always contested the loss and victim amount from day one. So they've always contested this finding that the district court made as to the loss and the victims. And from their briefs, it does appear in some ways that they have been arguing both the jointly undertaken criminal activity and also reasonable foreseeability. But certainly they never did raise the issue of the scope directly to the judge at sentencing. And that's why it's perfectly reasonable that the judge implicitly adopted the government's suggestion of the scope and the government's references to the entire scheme and the scheme throughout the course of sentencing, to which there was never an objection.
But you may have waived your ability to rely on plain error.
Yes.
If you're willing to say that it's all clear error, and if it's a clear error standard, the district court's failure to start at step one and make a finding on the scope, just seems it's a shame when time like that gets wasted, because if this had been brought out, I assume the district court would have made that finding. But there it is in the guideline, and there's this gaping, absence in the record.
Well, Your Honor, this court has held before.
This is, by the way, something that at least I have noticed in a bunch of appeals, not today, but in other days. It looks like district judges in Northern Illinois and several of our other districts have just stopped making findings about the jointly undertaken criminal activity component of the relevant conduct guidelines and have assumed that everything is now to be shoveled into the foreseeability category. And that's a serious problem. They've got to make findings on both, and one hopes that even when the defense is asleep at the switch, perhaps an assistant U.S. attorney will remind them that they've got to address both issues.
And, Your Honor, we would certainly agree that the record could have been better in the district court at the sentencing hearing and that there could have been better findings. But this court has held in the past that the lack of an express finding does not bar upholding a relevant conduct finding when the record fully supports that finding. And the court held this in Acosta, and if you read the Thomas opinion, you can see there that the court did the same thing. When the district court's words were not entirely using the specific phraseology, if you will, of the guidelines, but the import was there, and the facts in the record were sufficient to support the relevant conduct finding.
So where, in your opinion, does the district court come closest to saying something about the scope?
Well, I believe what the district court, when he listens to and refers to it as the scheme, and when he talks about the connections between the defendants and the other co-schemers for which they are held liable, he's touching upon facts that, while they do refer and support the reasonable foreseeability finding, they also support the finding of jointly undertaken criminal activity.
But when he I don't get that. I mean, when he says the scheme, I don't see how that throws light on the scope of the scheme. We need an adjective somehow. We need, you know, more information.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's that taken in comport with all of the other facts that he's discussing and the connections between the defendants here today and the other defendants for whose conduct they were ultimately held liable.
So you're saying that there's actually really no sentence or no passage in the record that we can look to that we can say, well, even though he wasn't really spelling it out, here is where, in essence, he made this finding. There is no such place.
I believe in Salem's sentencing transcript, I could point you to a place on page 12 where he finds that Salem and certain co-schemers participated in the scheme. And also at the beginning of the sentencing, the district court does refer to the two-part test for jointly undertaken criminal activity, where he states that the conduct must be both in furtherance of the jointly undertaken criminal activity and reasonably foreseeable to that defendant before the defendant can be held liable for the conduct of others.
But he never says, first I have to define the jointly undertaken criminal activity and then see what's in furtherance and what's reasonably foreseeable.
Those words.
He never puts in step one.
That's correct. He does not make the statement out of application note two. That is correct. But by referring to the test for jointly undertaken criminal activity, the district court is making clear that he is aware that both elements of jointly undertaken criminal activity and reasonable foreseeability are required before a finding of liability for the conduct of others can be made as to the defendant.
I'm not sure I'd go quite so far as to say making clear, but maybe you might say hinting at.
Indicating, perhaps, Your Honor.
Okay.
I also, just before I run out of time, would like to address the fact that Sotopiedro did not change the law of this circuit on jointly undertaken criminal activity. Contrary to what the defendants are arguing for today, if this court were to adopt their reading of Sotopiedro, that the defendants must assist or agree to promote specific acts or conduct of another co-schemer before they could be held liable for them, that would actually collapse and completely gut jointly undertaken criminal activity and really roll it into aiding and abetting liability under the relevant conduct provisions. And unless there are any further questions, we would ask that this court uphold the sentences of Salem, Simon, and Ganescu.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Handelsman?
Oh, yes. Review, standard review would be clear error if we were disputing a finding of fact. We're not disputing a finding of fact. It's our position here. The evidence in this record was insufficient to prove that these defendants were engaging in jointly undertaking activity with every act and every other co-conspirator shown on Appendix 14 through 22. Now, the government uses similar conduct, which there obviously was here, to show jointly undertaken activity. And that's directly contrary to example C7. And the fact that that certain things happen is not evidence of jointly undertaken activity. The government needs to show that the individual defendants were actually involved in obtaining the cell phone numbers and the false IDs and hiring the lawyer. These bottom-of-the-pyramid defendants certainly did not make the decision of where to send the money. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Handelsman. Anything further, Ms. Kister?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mr. Handelsman, Ms. Kister, we appreciate your willingness to undertake the appointment in this case.
I was very instrumental in this program.
We thank you, too.